This is 10, and it's also lesson 10. The findings of this course have supported the view that an extensive core of the biblical counseling approach must be extracted from Scripture, and that psychology has a contribution to make at the periphery. In this lesson, we will describe some of those aspects of psychology that we feel make a valid and helpful contribution. Psychological concepts can be grouped into three categories. We have already discussed two of these. The first is the scientific findings of research psychology. Some of the findings of research psychology are not valid, but many are. Second, there are personality theories, which we have concluded are highly speculative, ineffective, and therefore invalid. A third category, which we have not discussed, consists of direct empirical observations made by psychologists that have not been substantiated scientifically, but seem to have validity. These observations differ from the findings of research psychology in that they have not been verified by formal scientific research. They differ from personality theory in that they do not comprise broad speculative theories, but are more concise findings that are more the product of direct observation than are personality theories. In other words, personality theories are these broad speculative things that are philosophically oriented and deal with in-depth aspects of the human personality, whereas the types of concepts we're talking about here are more directly empirical, narrower, more concise type concepts. Many of these findings come from the work of psychotherapists who observe patterns of human behavior in their work with counselees. An example of this type of observation might be the sleep patterns of depressed people or the control factor related to anorexia. Though such concepts must be scrutinized carefully, they can be useful in understanding people and their problems. Let's talk for a few minutes about litmus tests in examining psychological ideas before embracing them. It is imperative that the biblical counselor carefully scrutinize pronouncements of psychology before embracing and utilizing them. Let me suggest three litmus tests that psychological concepts should pass before we adopt them. The first and most important one is whether the concept is compatible with a biblical worldview. The evangelical community has erred grievously at this point by being far too casual in its theological scrutiny of psychological concepts. It is absolutely essential to recognize that theology is an exact science. It is no more acceptable to adopt a psychological concept that is somewhat parallel to a biblical one than it is for a mechanic to utilize a part that seems somewhat similar to the one that he is replacing. Therefore, the need is for more than casual scrutiny. The theological bar for adopting psychological concepts must be very high. It has not been. It needs to be. A second litmus test is whether the concept has empirical validity. This is not an easy test because, as mentioned earlier, even where extensive research has been done, it is easy for psychological research to be skewed. Therefore, we must approach psychological concepts with something of a critical attitude. We must be especially watchful when findings do not fit comfortably either within a biblical worldview or an intuitive view of the world. In fact, it has been my experience that a more common sense analysis of psychological concepts at times provides a better guide than research in determining the validity of a psychological concept. In other words, regardless of what the research says, if the concept makes sense to us, if it seems to be compatible with our experience of the world, that seems to be a better measure most of the time. Some of the useful concepts listed below are not the product of formal psychological studies, but instead they flow out of more informal observation. Nonetheless, they appear to be more valid and useful than some highly researched psychological concepts that must be forced into a biblical or practical perspective on life. A third litmus test is whether or not a psychological concept is peripheral in nature. We have discovered that the Bible should be the source of our core concepts and that secular psychology should make its contribution at the periphery. When secular psychology does draw conclusions regarding core concepts, we find that they are either in error, such as the Oedipus complex, or superfluous, because the Bible has already clearly advanced them. For example, cognitive therapy's emphasis on the significance of the thought life. However, as with the case of cognitive therapy, peripheral concepts such as practical ways in which to deal with the person regarding his thought life are useful. It is my conclusion that after we weed out error using the litmus tests above, psychology still offers to the counselor a significant amount of usable and helpful input. Below, we will be looking at several general counseling areas in which the findings of psychology can be helpful. Other categories may exist, but these seem to be the most obvious and helpful. Within the general categories listed below, no doubt many specific types of input exist that can be helpful to the counselor in addition to the ones cited. This list just represents a sampling. The first category is categorization. One of the foundations of any discipline is the need to categorize. Categorization consists of labeling, defining phenomena. Without labeling, it is virtually impossible for a field to develop. For example, without a specific category for each plant, the findings of biologists would be filed in one huge folder labeled miscellaneous. As a result, it would be virtually impossible to develop our understanding of plant life. By labeling and defining various types of plants, biologists can begin to categorize plants and catalog discoveries relative to those plants, thus increasing scientific knowledge about them. In addition, labeling also enables the organization of knowledge, establishing the relationship of one category to another, and it also makes communication about a given field possible. Thus, advantages of categorizing include the capacity to accumulate and process knowledge so that we can advance in our understanding of the category, to communicate to each other about specific categories, and to postulate on the relationship between categories, thus enabling us to systematize our understanding. Therefore, without categorization, a field cannot be developed systematically and progress. Thus, the labeling of various categories pertaining to human personality and problems enables us to develop and organize our understanding of people and their problems to a much higher degree, and thus to enhance our capacity to minister to them. If we do not establish categories, every case that we treat represents a whole new world, and every counselor is isolated within his own world, unable to benefit from the findings of colleagues. Even theology has its own extra-biblical language, using terms like dichotomy and trichotomy. So with various ministries, such as missions, that coin words such as partnering. Likewise, all disciplines have their own vocabulary. If theologians cannot find biblical terms to express theological concepts, we cannot expect biblical counseling to do so, nor should we object when they develop their own vocabulary. Adopting categories related to specific disorders from psychology is a relatively safe practice, since the development of such categories is usually more empirical than philosophical in nature. That is, this work is to a large extent based on direct observation. Of course, philosophical bias can slip in anywhere. Therefore, the biblical counselor must not drop his guard. Nonetheless, because of the predominantly empirical nature of the categorization of psychological disorders, we can borrow and utilize much of the work of secular psychology in this area. The most formal and systematic categorization of disorders by psychology is found in DSM-IV, published by the American Psychiatric Association. Its careful delineation of the nature of disorders and its broad scope make this a valuable source. The publication is written from a secular perspective, and therefore its findings must be scrutinized using the criteria stated above. However, this source is relatively safe in that, for the most part, it is not philosophically laden, but is based primarily on empirical observations. Among other benefits, DSM-IV helps the counselor to identify a counselee's problem, giving the counselor information regarding to the related symptoms. In so doing, it enables him to draw on the experience of others dealing with the same problem. It also enables him to coordinate with others regarding a given case. For example, the biblical counselor at time finds himself needing to speak with a medical doctor, psychiatrist, social worker, or other person regarding a counselee he is working with. I have had several such instances in recent weeks. One involved a person seeking to gain admittance to a Christian drug rehabilitation program. This organization required a formal five-axis DSM-IV psychological evaluation. In this case, a knowledge of DSM-IV enabled me to communicate with this organization in a format that was acceptable to them. As already stated, I am not advocating the wholesale endorsement and utilization of DSM-IV by biblical counselors. However, I believe it is a mistake for biblical counselors to neglect the substantial amount of information contained in this volume. Some evangelicals have resisted categorization for various reasons. They see labeling of problems as an endorsement of the medical model. That is, it suggests that these problems are illnesses rather than areas in which the human being is responsible. However, this connotation is not a product of categorization per se. Categorization only describes the nature of problems. It does not connote that the person is not responsible for the problem or incapable of dealing with it. Of course, if people draw a parallel between categorizing psychological disorders and making a medical diagnosis, the practice of labeling could lead them to think in terms of the medical model. It is unfortunate if people read that implication into the labeling of psychological problems. However, categorizing using DSM-IV does not carry that implication per se. In other words, if a person gets that idea, it's because they read it in. The alternative is not to label psychological problems. Much would be lost by adopting this alternative. As noted earlier, this would prevent the biblical counselor from dealing with various problems on a systematic basis and systematically compiling and communicating knowledge regarding these problems. Such a barrier to progress would prove catastrophic, giving secular counselors a great advantage over biblical counselors. A second argument against categorization is that labeling of problems makes the individual feel hopeless, as if he is stuck in that category and that there's nothing he can do to change. He sees himself as, quote, one of those, end quote. Some secular sources express the same concern. This concern may contain some validity, especially if the counselor presents the problem with which the counselee is struggling as a disease or addiction. However, as already noted, the disease connotation is not inherent in categorization, but is read into it. Giving a name to a person's problem does not connote that it is a disease. One advantage to giving a label to a counselee's problem is that this might encourage the counselee that the counselor is conversant with this problem and thus may be able to help the counselee find a solution. Therefore, labeling can provide hope, and thus it only engenders hopelessness if the meaning of the label is misrepresented. It might be objected that our hope is in the Lord and not in counseling expertise. It certainly is true that the Lord constitutes the ultimate hope for dealing with our problems. However, it is also true that the Lord uses human beings with specific spiritual gifts as a means of dealing with problems. And as noted earlier, the utilization of spiritual gifts of all types, whether preaching, teaching, or evangelism, involves the development of an expertise, one that includes extra-biblical knowledge, in the utilization of these gifts. In wrapping up our discussion of DSM-IV, let me reiterate that I believe that much can be gained by its use, that the advantages far outweigh the dangers. Biblical counselors could develop their own version of DSM-IV, written from a thoroughly biblical perspective. However, such a publication does not exist at this time. Thus, we must utilize the tools that are available to us. Even if an evangelical DSM-IV were generated, using it instead of the secular model would hinder communication with the secular community of the type that was noted above. Another type of input that is useful to the biblical counselor is found in the rather extensive body of knowledge that has been amassed related to specific disorders. In addition to basic diagnostic descriptions regarding specific disorders, such as found in DSM-IV, psychology has developed a storehouse of information on various pathologies, some of which are not mentioned in the Bible, for example, Tourette's syndrome, and others which are alcoholism. In either case, added information is useful to the biblical counselor when encountering various problems, especially when he is confronting them for the first time. This information can help him understand what he is dealing with, what he must expect, and some treatments that have and have not worked. For example, if a counselor is not familiar with anorexia, he might assume that after rationally explaining to the counselee that she is not overweight, but instead substantially underweight, that she is hurting her health, that if she continues in the present course, she could even die, that she is creating tremendous anxiety for her loved ones, and that for many reasons her present course is displeasing to God, the counselor may think that she would recognize the obvious truth regarding each of these points and change her eating pattern. However, the counselor familiar with the literature related to anorexia will realize that such a response is highly unlikely. Therefore, he can be prepared for the counselee to be unresponsive to this rational sort of approach and ready to take the next step in his strategy in dealing with a counselee. A third type of secular input that can be helpful is that related to the administration of a counseling practice. Under this category, I am including all aspects of the counseling practice not directly included in the actual act of counseling, though the utilization of this type of input would differ depending on whether the biblical counselor was practicing in a church or had a private practice or counseled in some other venue. There is much practical wisdom that we can glean regardless of our counseling environment. Let me suggest some subcategories of administrative input. First, let's look at practical organizational issues. One of the more obvious ones has to do with room arrangement. Some room arrangements seem to work better than others. For example, not having a desk between the counselor and the counselee seems to be a major factor. The same might be said about approaches to running an office, the way the counselor dresses, and various office policies. Many of these factors may be cultural, with different arrangements working better in different cultural settings. A second administrative factor in the counseling practice that we want to look at has to do with ethical issues. The Bible provides the underlying ethical foundation for our practice. However, a wide range of ethical principles has been developed specifically related to the counseling field that are not addressed in the Bible as such. For example, principles related to confidentiality. The biblical counselor may not agree with all of the ethical principles established by the secular counseling profession. For example, one of the major ethical concerns in secular counseling is the dual relationship, that is, interacting with the counselee in more than one capacity. The biblical counselor, especially if he is a pastor, may conclude that it is biblical and even healthy to fulfill several roles related to the counselee. Nonetheless, the secular concern related to this issue provides a warning to the biblical counselor regarding the vulnerability of the counselee, thus encouraging the counselor to be careful not to take advantage of this relationship. Likewise, some evangelicals reject the typical teaching, the typical secular ethic regarding confidentiality. Yet it is still helpful to be apprised of the types of issues in question in the secular community and related implications, so that the biblical counselor can think them through from a biblical perspective and make advised decisions in regard to them. For example, in counseling a child, does a parent have the right to information we have gleaned? If so, at what age do we extend confidentiality to the child? Or if we are counseling husband and wife separately, should we commit ourselves to keeping the information supplied by one spouse from the other? One advantage to being aware of these confidentiality issues beforehand is that it enables us to address them before the counselee develops faulty assumptions and then becomes angry when his expectations are not fulfilled. For example, if a husband believes that what he offers in a counseling session will be kept from his wife, though this is not the counselor's policy, he will feel betrayed when the counselor divulges information to his spouse. Thus, it is helpful to be aware of these potential pitfalls up front, and a study of secular counseling ethics can give us that awareness. Therefore, even though the biblical counselor may not adopt the ethical conclusions of the secular counseling community, the work that has been done in these practical areas serves to make us aware of potential pitfalls so that we can establish biblical solutions, thus avoiding trouble. The literature related to these issues can help us to identify unforeseen problems and develop biblical solutions rather than learning the hard way. A substantial and important body of expertise has been developed pertaining to yet another administrative category, and that has to do with legal issues and the related pitfalls in counseling. For example, various laws exist related to the reporting of child abuse or giving testimony in court. As biblical counselors, our perspective on these issues may differ from conventional secular wisdom. However, being aware of the laws, related court cases, and conventional wisdom enables us to avoid problems and make decisions in advance regarding how to deal with legal problems should they arise. Many other issues could be cited related to the administrative aspects of a counseling practice in which secular expertise might be helpful, such as development of forms, in-processing counselees, office procedures, and termination of the counseling relationship. Biblical counselors have begun to develop their own body of expertise in many areas. However, it seems wise to learn all that we can from secular sources as well. Another area in which input from secular sources can be helpful has to do with the counseling process. The core aspects of the counseling process should flow out of Scripture. However, some of the peripheral contributions from extra-biblical sources can be useful. The examples below represent just a small sampling. First, let's consider interviewing a counselee. The interviewing approach taught in most secular psychology and counseling majors includes many helpful techniques such as maintaining eye contact, using body language to reflect interest, the use of open and closed questions to develop a relationship and glean information, and techniques for structuring the interviews such as summarizing, just to cite a few. Though many of these techniques may be self-evident, awareness of them and insights regarding how to utilize them is helpful. Though the basic concept of listening finds its source in Scripture, the biblical counselor can glean a lot of particulars about the art of listening from secular literature. And so here we have this concept that the core concept of being a good listener is a biblical concept, but we can get the particulars, the peripherals, from secular literature. All such techniques are merely specific applications of the foundational biblical concept of love. Love calls us to listen well. However, secular input can help us to know how to listen well. One example of a helpful extra-biblical insight related to the interviewing process concerns the need to wait until the counselee is fully presents the problem before problem-solving. One of the chief characteristics of a novice counselor is problem-solving too soon. This hurts the counseling process because the counselee does not feel that he has been fully heard, and in reality, he has not, and as a result, he may quit coming. Another problem with problem-solving too soon is that the counselor is usually solving the wrong problem if he does that. He really hasn't gotten to the root problem. And yet a third pitfall is that the counseling process becomes confused. In other words, you only get half the problem and you start working on that and it becomes all confused. So just the issue of learning to wait until you've heard the whole problem is something good that we can learn from the experts in interviewing. Let's talk about the use of inventories in counseling. One sensitive issue related to getting acquainted with the counselee and his problems has to do with whether or not the biblical counselor should use various inventories that are available, such as the MMPI, Taylor-Johnson Temperament Analysis, the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator, or others. One problem with some inventories is a bias against a Christian orientation to life. For example, some inventories contain questions such as, do you have any beliefs that you would die for? It's evident that an affirmative response to such a question connotes pathology. it seems that at least some inventories have made an effort to eliminate or avoid questions of this nature. Another objection to inventories is the belief that they are inaccurate, thus leading the counselor to wrongly judge the counselee. Each counselor needs to make this determination for himself regarding the validity of a given inventory or of inventories in general. Yet another problem with inventories for some biblical counselors is the sense that they label the individual. Our response to this objection is essentially the same as found in the discussion above regarding labeling. Some reject the use of inventories because they believe that the experienced counselor can glean an understanding of the counselee and his problems without their use. One consideration here is that though the counselor may understand the counselee's problem, the inventory at times can serve to convince the counselee that he has a problem. The inventory results flowing out of the counselee's own assessment of himself. Next, let's consider helpful techniques for interacting with the counselee about his problem. Many such techniques exist. Let me just look at two. The first one is what is frequently referred to as unique outcomes. This technique looks for successes in the past. The individual or couple having a problem in a given area often has experienced instances in which they have succeeded in this particular area in the past. Identifying such instances of success and seeking the cause for the success may reveal a key to dealing with the problem in the present. For example, a marriage that is characterized by almost constant hostility will nevertheless usually include some good times. Helping the couple discover why those times were good may enable them to replicate those experiences. Two added benefits of this approach is that it keeps the couple focused on the positive aspects of their marriage, and also it gives them hope based on their past successes. Though the couple's ultimate hope for a good marriage resides in the application of biblical principles and in the power of God to enable them to love each other, this type of technique helps them to see God's provision of such love in the past, thus encouraging them regarding the prospects of future success. Another technique that is helpful in counseling is reframing. This entails helping the individual to develop a different attitude toward a situation by viewing it from a different perspective, a more biblical one. For example, instead of the counselee viewing the long hours that a father spends at work as a lack of interest in him, he might perceive this practice as a sacrifice that his father makes to provide well for him and enable him to attend a good college. Consequently, rather than seeing his father's work as an expression of his self-centeredness, he would be viewing it as a token of his father's love. We see that in the use of this tool, the biblical worldview provides the foundation for counseling. In other words, what we're doing is helping the counselee to view things biblical, and reframing merely comprises a peripheral technique for leading the counselee to adopt a biblical worldview in specific areas. Many other such techniques that are helpful in counseling could be cited. Now let's turn our attention to effective practical approaches to treatment. The counseling process can also be enhanced by secular insights in the area of approaches to treatment. Though the solutions to most counseling issues ultimately reside in the appropriation and application of spiritual resources to the problem area, practical insights and techniques often contribute to this process. For example, the ultimate solution to uncontrolled spending is helping the counselee to understand that this constitutes a form of idolatry, and explaining to him how to appropriate and apply spiritual resources in order to change his life. Nonetheless, teaching the person an extra-biblical technique, such as how to make a budget, can benefit the process. Also, helping him to find a manageable way to restructure his present debt can be a means of giving him hope and bringing some order into his financial life.